In the 1970s, Robert Towne became known as one of the best screenwriters in Hollywood. He was brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, and he wrote the screenplays for The Last Detail, Shampoo, and Chinatown. In 1975, Pauline Kael described Towne as a flaky classicist with an ear for unaffected dialogue and a gift for never forcing a point. In 1982, Towne directed his own screenplay for the film Personal Best. Now Towne is back with the second film he both wrote and directed, the thriller Tequila Sunrise. It stars Mel Gibson and Kurt Russell as two former best friends who now seem to be on opposite sides of the law. Gibson plays a drug dealer who says he's gotten out of the business. Russell is a cop who's been assigned the job of busting his old friend. Michelle Pfeiffer plays the woman they're both in love with. After Pfeiffer has an affair with Russell, she accuses him of having used her and others to get information about Gibson's drug dealing.
You lie to me about Mac, you lie to Mac about me, you lie to the judge about everybody. Sooner or later you have to lose sight of the facts, don't you?
No. No, you don't lose sight of the facts, not unless you're nuts. You lose sight of your feelings. Mac knows how he feels. He's crazy about you and he doesn't want to get caught. For a crook, it's crystal clear. On the other hand, for a cop, it's confusing. Mac's my friend, and I like him. McGuire's my associate, and I hate him. I probably have to bust my friend if I'm going to do my job. And I hate that, but I hate drug dealers, and somebody's got to get rid of Carlos. How do I do that?
Tequila Sunrise is in part about conflicting loyalties that make it sometimes necessary to maybe betray a friend or a colleague. Why were you interested in writing something about that theme? Does that relate to you personally at all?
Well, I think it relates to all of us who work in a business where your efforts to make a movie are so time-consuming that you can't tell your personal from your professional life apart, can't tell them apart. And any time that happens, you don't know whether you're dealing with a friend or a colleague or both, and it gets confusing. So I think it's something that is certainly germane to us in the making of movies in particular, and to, I think, everyone in general. I mean, since I can remember, there has been, I think, an increasing conflict among all of us about the wisdom of doing our job as against personal loyalties and personal friendships.
This is your first film since 1982 when you wrote and directed Personal Best. I know that that film ended in a lawsuit, and then you ended up going through a divorce and a custody battle. And I was wondering if those events were responsible for the hiatus between films.
Yes. What can I say? I think that it certainly put a dent in my ability to work professionally.
By that, do you mean that you personally weren't up for making a movie, or that it was hard for you to get others to give you the chance to make one?
Well, I mean, I'll never know that, really. Because the first time that I was able to complete writing something that I wanted to direct, which was Tequila Sunrise, I was given the opportunity to direct it. I do think that that when your real life, when your day-to-day life, when your becomes more interesting and fascinating than your fantasy life, it interferes with your ability to write fantasy because you're living it. And when melodramatic events occur in your life, when it just becomes time-consuming, then your ability to obsess about a fantasy is more limited. So I think that it necessarily interferes with your ability to work. I don't know whether or not, had I finished something in that time frame, I would have been given the opportunity to direct it. All I know is that when I did finish something, I was given the opportunity.
Well, this is the second film that you both wrote and directed. And I'm wondering if you take liberties in writing when you know that you're going to be directing it yourself, and you know, therefore, that the director will know what the writer meant in a certain scene.
No, I don't. I mean, I write a script no differently for myself than I do for anyone, for someone else. I think that in some ways it's more difficult directing your own script because you do make that assumption. You as the director, I as the director, make the assumption that I must know what this script is about since I wrote it. But the press of events on a set, all the technological problems and all the Rube Goldberg machinery of a movie is such that you are just as affected by it as any other director, and you may have less of a tendency to do what a director who has not written the script does do, which is to say, what is this scene really about it at the most basic level? And I think a writer-director has to constantly remind himself to ask the same question he would had he not written the script. What is this scene about?
I know as a writer you have to protect yourself, if you can, against wrong interpretations that that a director might take with a movie. I know that's happened to you, that you've had... I know you had a whole movie that you thought was totally misinterpreted, Greystoke. You had meant to direct it yourself, but it was taken away from you in a deal. And anyways, you hated the result so much you ended up putting your dog's name using your dog's name as your credit for screenwriter. Is there an example in a movie where a scene that you wrote was very misinterpreted and you were upset at the way it was interpreted by the director?
Well, let me just kind of go on record with Greystoke. I've never seen it, so I don't know what it is and isn't in relationship to the script that I wrote. I've only been told by people who have seen it that it doesn't bear a lot of relationship to my script. And therefore, I took my name off it simply because I wouldn't want my name on something, even if it was good, if I wasn't really responsible for it. So that's just a matter kind of bookkeeping, really.
Mm-hmm.
As far as an example of a scene going wrong, I don't know that that occurs to me as readily as scenes that go right. I mean, it's been the thing that you learn when you're working is that the best thing that can happen to you as a writer is to see a scene that you've written and imagined properly. I know that in the case of Tequila, though, that the actors who were first reading the script would tend to read into the situation a great deal more surface intensity than I intended. And when I would ask them to kind of lay off and be casual with the dialogue, they realized that it was, in fact, funny and not melodramatic. And that probably would never have happened had I not been able to be there to kind of kick the attitude more toward the attitude of Shampoo than at least in the surface textures, than some kind of highly melodramatic situation, and let the melodrama just build in terms of the structure rather than the surface tone.
Can you think of an example of a particular line or sequence where the meaning was totally changed by the line reading, by the way it was delivered?
Well, let me see. I think in terms of Tequila, we're talking about an early scene with Kurt and Mel when they're talking, and Kurt sits down and confronts Mel in the restaurant about an activity that had happened earlier in the evening when Mel had been nearly busted on a supposed drug deal. And Kurt says, the federal government swears you're doing business in here. And Mel says, why? And Kurt says, well, what do you mean, why? You're a drug dealer and you don't pay your taxes. Now, just the levity with which the casual nature with which he said that, I think actually changed the scene. Other people who had read it were trying to be extremely intense with it, and it was dead wrong. These are guys whose attitude is to try to minimize the potential hazards of any confrontation. Because in my experience, guys who are in potentially life-threatening situations try to minimize the implications of that as much as possible by being as casual as anybody having dinner and talking about pasta. I think that's a general example of where tone really affects the text.
Robert Towne is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise. As a screenwriter and director, you have to work with silences in movies, and I think you've used silence very effectively both as a screenwriter and director. In Chinatown, for instance, there are scenes where Nicholson is trailing, for instance, Faye Dunaway, and I mean, there isn't any dialogue in that, but it's very gripping, and you had to imagine that in your mind. In Personal Best, there are sequences where there really isn't a lot of dialogue at all. It's very visual. It's interactive between the two characters. Does silence have a different meaning when you're writing and when you're directing? And is it frustrating as a writer to write silences in?
No, it's not. I think that so much of screenwriting is what I guess you would call, if you were an architect, negative space. In screenwriting, what you don't say is at least as important as what you do say. I don't find it frustrating at all. I find it demanding. It's a discipline to try to imagine exactly how much you don't want said. And one of the benefits, of course, of directing is that you can control that. It is a difficult thing to control. You can put it on the page, but you can't really control how it's going to be implemented, which, of course, is a reason for directing yourself.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. Screenwriter and director Robert Towne is my guest. This is Fresh Air. My guest Robert Towne wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise, which stars Kurt Russell, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Mel Gibson. Towne also wrote and directed the film Personal Best and wrote the screenplays for Chinatown, The Last Detail, and Shampoo. You wrote the screenplay for Chinatown. Roman Polanski directed it. Polanski played a small role in the film. He played the part of a henchman who's hired to intimidate Nicholson to get off the case. And what Polanski does is take out a pocket knife, stick it into Nicholson's nose, and basically slit his nostril open. Whose idea was it to cast Polanski in the role? Was it yours or his?
I think that was Roman's idea.
The line that you gave him to say was, "Know what happens to nosy fellows? They lose their noses." Why did you want to cut the nose? It seems like such an interesting, really offbeat way of hurting somebody.
Well, I was looking for a way to do something that I felt would appeal to your imagination in terms of just a tiny little violent act that was scary. I really didn't want to go into the kinds of violence that had been rife throughout films at that time. I wanted to have a minimal amount of violence, but I wanted to suggest that it was nevertheless a very violent world out there. So I thought of something that I would really hate to have happen to me, and it was that. And it seemed appropriate for a detective anyway. A detective who is, you know, like a hound, is, you know, sniffing out the trail of some kind of criminal or villain. It just seemed like the perfect thing to do.
What was very subversive about it was that it meant that Jack Nicholson, the leading man, had a bandage on his nose for half the movie. And even when he took the bandage off, he had a big cut and stitches on his nose.
Well, once again, in most movies, you can see people fight in a way that would have crushed skulls, created probably, you know, quadriplegics on with both combatants, and they emerge unscathed from the battle and continue to go out throughout the film with a bruise here or there, which disappears in the next scene. Well, in fact, that doesn't happen. I mean, if somebody gets hurt, it hurts. Just a tiny little slit in your nose can really smart, and it can affect the way you look and feel for weeks, and in this case, for the rest of the movie. It was just an attempt to just like Chinatown was an attempt to deal with a real crime that involves something as seemingly prosaic as land and water, That little act of violence was an attempt to suggest that you can really hurt people by doing almost nothing at all, just a tiny little slit of their nose.
I want to ask you a little bit about writing a climactic scene, a scene in which there's really a turning point in the story or in their character development. In Chinatown, the real turning point scene, or at least one of them, is when Faye Dunaway reveals that the woman whose identity she's been hiding is really her daughter as a result of an incestuous relationship. Her father had, the Faye Dunaway father had raped her when she was 15. And I want to just play a clip from this scene and then ask you a little bit about the considerations in writing this kind of climax.
I don't know what you are talking about. This is the craziest, the most insane thing.
Stop it! I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. He hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl is a witness. So you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you got the money to keep her mouth shut. Yes or no?
No!
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister and my daughter.
It's a really such a dramatic way of bringing across that revelation, and to have the, especially with the slaps in between, you know, that's, I don't know if people can make that out in the clip that we heard. But can I ask you about planning that, writing that climax, and if you had written in the slaps, if you thought that that would add to the drama of the moment?
Well, yes, they were written in. I think that any revelation of any kind is only credible, particularly one that is shameful, at least whether or not there's any moral stigma attached to it. It certainly is embarrassing for the Faye Dunaway character to have to admit to it. And the only way you're going to believe that what she says is true is if she's reluctant to talk about it, and that's putting it mildly. I think that, as a general rule, anything that you want an audience to believe is something that a character has to reveal reluctantly. Any kind of free and easy revelation is one that I think we automatically suspect is not true. We just, you know, glibness is whether or not it is in fact true. It's certainly dramatically true that glibness is generally tantamount to insincerity.
Chinatown has one of the most often repeated lines of recent film history, and that is just about the last line of the film, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." And that's said by one of Nicholson's assistants after everything's gone wrong, after Faye Dunaway's been killed and the evil father is free. How did you come up with that line? Did you realize it would have as much resonance as it did and that people would be repeating it for years after?
No, but the line was intended to be what it is, and I guess it just worked. Chinatown itself, I guess, is a sort of metaphor for the futility of good intentions. You simply individual actions don't necessarily matter, even though we'd like them to, even though we'd all like to be like Rambo and think we could single-handedly win a war that we lost, and Chinatown suggests that a good man, or a man who is not necessarily good all the time but would like to do something decent, has his hands full when he tries to disentangle the Gordian knot that is really the kind of thing that most of us have to disentangle if we're going to do anything decent, which is kind of applicable in a way to Tequila Sunrise, which where the cop again has to confront the fact that he's in a real thicket in terms of who's good and who's bad and how much good he's going to do by as a result of his actions by busting his friend. And I think that his dilemma is not dissimilar to the Nicholson characters in Chinatown. He has to make a choice. Does he do his job, or does he honor loyalties? And most of us, ever since we've seen popular entertainments like James Bond, where he's licensed to kill, have always felt that, we've kind of worshipped the job. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. We've got to get those, we've got to destroy the city in order to save it. We've got to win at all costs. And I think that you have to reach a point where you say, do I have to win at all costs? Is it, am I going to be saving more than I'm destroying? And that the answer to that is a little bit different in Tequila than it was in Chinatown, but the question is the same question, and that is the connecting link, I think, between the two of them.
In a way, in Hollywood, one of the ways you got your start was as a script doctor. You were brought in to solve problems on movies that, I guess, had serious problems with them. You were brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and for The Godfather. Could you give me an example of the type of problem you were brought in to solve on one of those two screenplays? Yeah.
On The Godfather, there had never been a scene in the novel that existed between Marlon and Al Pacino. Where the father, whose favorite son was the one that was to take over as the head of this criminal family. There had never been a scene where he was able to sit down and say, you're going to take over and this is what it's going to be. And they needed it. And suddenly they came to the point where they were going to lose Marlon in 24 hours, and they didn't have that scene. And they basically, as it was originally suggested to me, wanted a scene where the father let the son know he loved him. And it was my job to go in and write that scene, which I did by suggesting that the father's concern for his son and his son's future and his need to take over, because he was the only one who was fit to take over this criminal business, was so great that he was obsessively worried about all the day-to-day details of bodyguards and phones and tapped phones. And through expressing that concern, he let his son know that he was bitterly sorry that he had to pass on the dubious honor of being the head of the family. And the son let the father know that he accepted because it was inevitable, and I wrote the scene.
Were there directors who let you on the set, let you sit in before you started directing yourself? And I ask this knowing that a lot of times screenwriters aren't really welcomed on the screen because the director wants to be able to make choices himself or herself without the screenwriter standing over their shoulder and making their own suggestions.
I have always been, maybe it's because I started so much of my work by doing rewrites that I didn't have the kind of threatening cachet of the originator of a piece of material, which I think is always a threat to a director, since it reminds him that he's in the role of basically an interpretive artist. And since I wasn't in that position, I was less of a threat in the early stages of my career, and it did allow me to be on sets. I was expected to be on sets because I was rewriting very often on a daily basis and had to be there with the pages for everyone to go over what I'd done to see if it was going to work. So I automatically spent a great deal of time on sets. Almost every director I ever worked with not only allowed me on the set, but insisted on it.
Is that how you learned how to direct, by watching?
I don't know how anybody learns to direct. I suppose the best training I had was how I learned to write, by being in acting classes and watching really fine actors improvise. I think that it not only helped me in terms of screenwriting, but it probably was the single best training I had to work with actors in movies.
One last question about Tequila Sunrise. I feel like I maybe shouldn't give away the ending. I'm sure you'd prefer that I don't. But you had a choice to make there about whether this was going to be a happy ending or an unhappy ending. And I'd be interested in what goes through your mind when you're making that kind of decision.
I think that in the without giving away the ending, I think we can still talk about it. I think that an unhappy ending would have made, in the case of Tequila Sunrise, you have if one of the two men dies, that movie becomes about that man and that man alone. He becomes a tragic figure. If the men survive, then it becomes about the nature of their relationship and the nature of relationships in general. I think it's more complex if somebody survives, and I think that the choice that you make is one where the characters and what they stand for remain on more of an equivalent level. The cop and the criminal are of virtually equal importance thematically if they survive. If either one of them dies, whether it's the cop or whether it's the criminal, then the character who dies becomes the most important character in the movie. So you must understand then that the writer obviously felt given that choice, it tells you what the writer thinks about those characters. If they survive, then he thinks they're both equally important.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us about movies. Thank you for your time. My guest has been Robert Towne, and he wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise, which stars Michelle Pfeiffer, Kurt Russell, and Mel Gibson. His earlier credits include the screenplays for the films Chinatown, The Last Detail, and Shampoo, and he also wrote and directed the film Personal Best. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.